therapy for patients with severe depressions that return on many occasions. A prophylactic effect can sometimes be achieved if you take the antidepressant over a period of a year or two after you have recovered. That can minimize the probability of your depression returning. If you have had a significant problem with recurrences of depression over a period of years, this might be a wise step for you. But you should be reassured that antidepressant drugs are definitely not addictive. In my practice through the years, I've had very few patients who have had to remain on antidepressant drugs for more than a year, and almost no patients who stayed on antidepressants indefinitely. Myth number 6. I won't take any psychiatric drug because that would mean I was crazy. This is quite misleading. Antidepressants are given for depression, not for craziness. If your doctor recommends an antidepressant, this would indicate he or she is convinced you have a mood problem. It does not mean that she or he thinks you are crazy. However, it is crazy to refuse an antidepressant on this basis because you may bring about greater misery and suffering for yourself. Paradoxically, you may feel normal more quickly with the help of the medicine. Myth number 7. But other people are bound to look down on me if I take an antidepressant. They'll think I'm inferior. This fear is unrealistic. Other people will not know you're taking an antidepressant unless you tell them. There's no other way they could know. If you do tell someone, they're more likely to feel relieved. If they care about you, they'll probably think more of you because you're doing something to help eliminate your painful mood disorder. Of course, it is possible that someone might question you about the advisability of taking a drug or even criticize your decision. This will give you the golden opportunity to learn to cope with disapproval and criticism along the lines discussed in Chapter 6. Sooner or later, you're going to have to decide to believe in yourself and stop giving in to the disabling terror that someone might or might not agree with something you do. Myth number 8. It is shameful to have to take a pill. I should be able to eliminate the depression on my own. Research on mood disorders conducted throughout the world has clearly shown that many individuals can recover without pills if they engage in an active, structured self-help program of the type outlined in this book. However, it is also clear that psychotherapy does not work for everyone and that some depressed patients recover faster with the help of an antidepressant. In addition, in many cases, an antidepressant can facilitate your efforts to help yourself, as described above. Does it really make sense to mope and suffer endlessly, stubbornly insisting you must do it on your own without a medication? Obviously, you must do it yourself, with or without a pharmacological boost. An antidepressant may give you that little edge you need to begin to cope in a more productive manner. This can accelerate the natural healing process. Myth number 9. I feel so severely depressed and overwhelmed that only a drug could help me. Drugs and psychotherapy both have a lot to offer in the treatment of severe depression. I believe that the passive attitude of letting a drug do it for you is unwise. My own research has indicated that the willingness to do something to help yourself can have powerful antidepressant effects, whether or not you are also taking a medication. The self-help work patients complete between sessions also seems to speed recovery. So if you combine a medication with a good form of psychotherapy, you will have more weapons in your arsenal. As I have already stated, many patients I have treated with drugs alone did not recover completely. When I added the cognitive therapy, many of them improved. I believe that the combination of drugs and psychotherapy can work better and quicker than drugs alone and frequently leads to better long-term results. This seems to be true for mildly depressed patients and for severely depressed patients as well. For example, we treat many severely depressed inpatients at the Stanford University Hospital with group cognitive therapy techniques. These techniques are similar to the ones you have learned about in this book. We have found that the group format can be especially helpful. I have seen many of these patients improve significantly during these therapy groups. The improvement often occurs within the actual therapy group. At the moment the patient sees how to talk back to his or her negative thoughts in a convincing manner, there is often a strong immediate uplift in mood and outlook. Keep in mind that these inpatients also receive antidepressant drugs that their attending psychiatrists prescribe for them. So nearly all of them receive a combination of drugs and psychotherapy. We are not purists devoted only to one approach or the other. I can recall one woman who was so severely depressed that she would burst into tears almost every time she tried to speak. If you even looked at her, it seemed it was enough to trigger an outburst of uncontrollable sobbing. I asked what she was thinking about when she was sobbing. She said she was thinking about something that her psychiatrist told her. He said her depression was biological and the causes were genetic. She concluded that if the depression was genetic, it meant she must have passed it down to her children and her grandchildren. One of her sons was, in fact, having a hard time. She attributed this to his depression gene and blamed herself for ruining his life. She castigated herself for even having gotten married and given birth to children in the first place, and felt certain they would all endure horrible suffering forever. As she explained this, she began sobbing again. Now, from your perspective, her self-blame may seem incredibly unrealistic. Her insistence that all her children and grandchildren would lead lives of endless and irreversible suffering may seem equally unrealistic. But from her perspective, all her self-criticisms seemed entirely justified, and negative predictions seemed completely valid. Her self-loathing and suffering were incredibly intense. After she stopped crying, I asked what she would say to another depressed woman with children. Would she be so hard on her? This intervention did not work. She did not even seem to comprehend what I said. Instead of answering my question, she sobbed so uncontrollably that her entire body shook as the tears streamed down her cheeks. After a while, she stopped crying again. I asked if two other patients would volunteer to do a role play to help her out. I call this exercise externalization of voices because you verbalize the negative thoughts in your mind and learn to talk back to them. I wanted the other patients to illustrate how she might talk back to her own negative thoughts so that all she would have to do was watch. I told her to imagine that these other women were very similar to her. They were depressed and had children and grandchildren. The first volunteer played the role of the negative part of her mind and said out loud the sort of things the depressed woman had been thinking. If my depression is partly genetic, then it means I am to blame for my son's depression. The second volunteer played the role of the more positive, realistic, self-loving part of her mind. This volunteer talked back to the negative thought along these lines. I certainly wouldn't blame another depressed woman for her son's depression, so it makes no sense to blame myself either. If there is a conflict with my son, or if he is having problems, I can try to be helpful to him. That's what any loving mother would try to do. Then they continued with this dialogue and modeled ways she could talk back to her other self-critical thoughts. The two volunteers took turns in the roles of the negative thoughts and the positive thoughts. After the role play was over, I asked the tearful patient which voice was winning and which voice was losing. Was it the negative voice or the positive voice? Which voice was more realistic, more believable? She said that the negative voice was unrealistic and that the positive voice was winning. I pointed out that the volunteers were actually verbalizing her own self-criticisms. Although her depression did not improve dramatically by the end of that group, it seemed that the clouds lifted just a little bit. The next time I saw her in a group, her mood had brightened up considerably. She was quite personable and could talk without crying for the first time since admission. She said she wanted to practice the role-playing in the group so she could learn how to do it. She said she was also intent on getting a referral to a cognitive therapist near her home after discharge so she could continue the work that was proving to be so helpful to her. The method that helped this patient is also called the double standard technique. It is based on the idea that many of us operate on a double standard. We may judge ourselves in a harsh, critical, demanding way, and yet we judge others in a more compassionate and reasonable manner. The idea is to give up this double standard and agree to judge all human beings, including ourselves, by one set of standards that is based on truth and compassion, instead of using a separate standard that is distorted and mean when we judge ourselves. Myth number 10. It is shameful to receive psychotherapy because it means I am weak or neurotic. It is more acceptable to be treated with a drug because it means I have a medical illness like diabetes. Actually, the sense of shame is common in depressed patients who are treated with drugs or psychotherapy. Often the double standard technique just described above can be helpful. Imagine, for example, that you've just discovered that a dear friend of yours received psychotherapy for depression and found that the treatment was helpful. Ask yourself what you would say to your friend. Would you say, "Oh, the psychotherapy just shows what a weak and defective neurotic you are. You should have taken a drug instead. What you did was shameful." If you would not say this to a friend, then why give yourself these messages? That's the essence of the double standard technique. Myth number 11. My problems are real, so psychotherapy couldn't possibly help me. Actually, cognitive therapy seems to work the best with depressed individuals with real problems in their lives, including catastrophic medical problems such as terminal cancer or an amputation, bankruptcy, or severe personal relationship problems. In many cases, I have seen individuals with problems like this who improved in a handful of cognitive therapy sessions. In contrast, chronically depressed individuals without any obvious problems that trigger their depressions are often more difficult to treat. Although the prognosis is excellent, they may require more intensive and prolonged treatment. Myth number 12. My problems are hopeless, so no psychotherapy or drug could possibly help me. This is your depression talking and not reality. Hopelessness is a common but horrible symptom of depression that is based on twisted thinking, just as the other symptoms are. One of the distortions is called emotional reasoning. The depressed individual may reason, "I feel hopeless, therefore I must be hopeless." Another cognitive distortion that leads to feelings of hopelessness is fortune-telling. You are making a negative prediction that you will never improve, and assuming this prediction is really a fact, other distortions can lead to feelings of hopelessness as well. These include the following. All-or-nothing thinking. You think of yourself as completely happy or completely depressed. Shades of gray do not count. So if you are not completely happy or completely recovered, you assume you are completely depressed and hopeless. Overgeneralization. You see your current feelings of depression as a never-ending pattern of defeat and suffering. Mental filter. You selectively think of all the times you have been depressed and end up thinking your whole life will be bad forever. Discounting the positive. You insist that the times you were not depressed don't count. Should statements. You use up all your energy telling yourself you shouldn't be depressed or you shouldn't have gotten depressed again instead of systematically working to overcome the feelings. Labeling. You tell yourself you are hopelessly and irreversibly defective and conclude that you could never really feel whole or happy or worthwhile. Other cognitive distortions such as magnification or personalization can also lead to feelings of hopelessness. Although these feelings are not realistic, they can act like self-fulfilling prophecies. If you give up, nothing will change, and you will conclude that you really were hopeless. Patients who feel hopeless usually cannot see that they are deceiving themselves. They are nearly always convinced these feelings are entirely valid. If I can persuade them to challenge these hopeless feelings and try to get better, even though they feel in their hearts that this is impossible, they usually do begin to improve, slowly at first, and then more rapidly, until they feel a whole lot better. One of the most important tasks of any therapist is to help depressed patients find the courage and determination to resist and fight these hopeless feelings. This battle is often fierce and rarely easy, but nearly always rewarding in the long run. Chapter 19. What You Need to Know About Commonly Prescribed Antidepressants. This chapter contains practical general information about the use of antidepressants. You will learn who is the most and least likely to benefit from an antidepressant, how you can tell whether an antidepressant drug is really working, how much mood elevation you can anticipate, how long you should stay on it, and what you can do if it doesn't work. You will also learn how to monitor and minimize side effects and prevent potentially dangerous interactions between antidepressants and other drugs you may take, including prescription drugs as well as non-prescription over-the-counter drugs you can obtain at the drugstore or grocery store. In the next chapter, I will provide specific information about each antidepressant and mood-stabilizing drug currently in use. When you read this chapter, keep in mind that the use of antidepressants is still a blend of art and science. Each practitioner has a slightly different philosophy, and your doctor's approach may differ from mine. I will state my own biases up front. First, I'm quite demanding in terms of what I expect from an antidepressant. I believe that any antidepressant medication should have a pretty profound and dramatic effect in order to justify its continued use. In addition, I firmly believe that every patient taking antidepressants should take a mood test like the one in Chapter 2 at least once a week. Your score on this test, or any other good depression test, is a highly reliable measure of how well your antidepressant is working. I do not encourage patients to continue taking drugs that have only modest or questionable beneficial effects on mood. When the score on the test goes down only a little bit, for example, a 30% or 40% improvement, I would be inclined to call this a placebo effect and not a real drug effect. This amount of improvement could be due to the passage of time, the psychotherapy, or the belief that the drug will work. If the improvement in mood is minimal, and assuming the patient has had a sufficient dose of the medication for a sufficient period of time, I would probably take the patient off the drug and try another medication, a combination of medication and psychotherapy, or psychotherapy alone. Now, some readers may think, but a 40% improvement in my mood sounds pretty good. This sounds like real improvement. I'm almost half better. Certainly, any improvement is desirable, but research studies indicate that inactive placebos can also have large antidepressant effects. A 40% improvement has been shown to be a typical placebo response. The only justification for taking any antidepressant drug is this: is the drug doing its job? To my way of thinking, the goal of treatment is to recover from depression. Most patients want complete recovery, not just a slight or moderate improvement in their mood. If an antidepressant is not accomplishing this goal after a reasonable trial, then I would recommend switching to another drug or treatment approach. Second, I never treat patients with medications alone. If I prescribe an antidepressant for a patient, I always combine the medication treatment with psychotherapy as well. Although I tried the medication-only approach with large numbers of patients early in my career, I almost never found this approach to be satisfactory. For example, when I was a postdoctoral fellow following my residency training at the University of Pennsylvania, I ran the lithium clinic at the Philadelphia VA Hospital. I treated many depressed veterans suffering from bipolar manic depressive illness with a combination of lithium and other antidepressant drugs. Although the medications appeared to be helpful, the results were not very encouraging. Most of these poor veterans were going in and out of the hospital almost constantly, and few were leading productive, joyous, stable lives. Later in my career, when I learned cognitive therapy, I treated all my manic depressive patients with a combination of medications plus psychotherapy. The results were much better. From that point on, I can recall only one manic depressive patient I treated who required hospitalization for an episode of mania. The results with depressed patients were similar. Early in my career, I treated depressed patients with the drugs alone or drugs combined with traditional supportive psychotherapy. I administered a depression test, like the one in Chapter 2, to every patient every session. I could see very clearly that while some patients were helped a lot by antidepressants, many were not. A lot of patients improved only slightly, and some did not improve at all. Later in my career, I began to combine antidepressant drugs with the new cognitive therapy techniques I was learning, and saw much better results. Eventually, I gave up treating patients with drugs alone. Third, I usually use one medication at a time rather than a combination of many different kinds of drugs, although there are certainly many exceptions to this, or any rule. The idea behind polypharmacy is that if one drug is good, two, three, or more will be even better. Some doctors also use additional drugs to try to combat the side effects of other drugs the patient is taking. The potential drawbacks to polypharmacy are many, including more side effects and more possible adverse drug interactions. I discuss polypharmacy in detail at the end of Chapter 20 and describe a number of specific situations in which the use of more than one drug may be justified. Finally, I have usually not kept patients on antidepressant drugs indefinitely following recovery. Instead, I slowly taper patients off their antidepressants after they have been feeling really good for several months. I have found that in most cases, patients who have recovered can continue to remain undepressed without medications. Keep in mind that all my patients have received cognitive therapy, whether or not they also received an antidepressant. The cognitive therapy is probably responsible for the good long-term results because patients learn tools they can use for the rest of their lives whenever they are feeling upset. Many doctors practice very differently. They tell their patients that they must continue taking their antidepressants indefinitely to correct a chemical imbalance in the brain and to prevent relapses into depression. While relapse is an important issue, I have found that training patients to use their cognitive therapy tools whenever they need them seems to maintain improvement following recovery. In fact, a number of well-controlled, long-term follow-up studies have confirmed that this works better than drugs to prevent relapses. While this is my philosophy in a nutshell, remember that there is no single correct approach, and your doctor's philosophy might differ from mine. In addition, there are many exceptions to any rule, and your own diagnosis or personal history may mandate a different approach from the one I have just outlined. If you have questions about your treatment, discuss your concerns with your physician. In my experience, the sense of teamwork and mutual respect is still the most important ingredient in any successful treatment. If I am depressed, does it mean that I have a chemical imbalance in my brain? There is an almost superstitious belief in our culture that depression results from a chemical or hormonal imbalance of some type in the brain. But this is an unproven theory and not a fact. As discussed in Chapter 17, we still do not know the cause of depression, and we do not know how or why antidepressant drugs work. The theory that depression results from a chemical imbalance has been around for at least 2,000 years, but there is still no proof of this, so we really do not know for sure. Furthermore, there is no test or clinical symptom that could demonstrate that a particular patient or group of patients has a chemical imbalance that is causing the depression. If I am depressed, does it mean that I should take an antidepressant? Many people also believe that if you are depressed, you should be on an antidepressant. However, I do not insist that every depressed patient must take an antidepressant. Large numbers of well-controlled studies published in respected scientific journals indicate that the newer forms of psychotherapy can be just as effective as, and sometimes more effective than, antidepressants. Certainly, many depressed people have been treated successfully with antidepressants and swear by them. They are valuable tools, and I am glad to have them available in my treatment arsenal. Sometimes antidepressants are helpful, but they are rarely total answers, and often they are not necessary. How can I decide whether or not to take an antidepressant? I always ask my patients during their initial evaluations whether or not they would prefer to take an antidepressant. If a patient strongly feels that she or he would prefer to be treated without an antidepressant, I treat with cognitive therapy alone, and this is usually successful. However, if the patient has been working hard in therapy for 6 to 10 weeks without any improvement, I sometimes suggest we try to add an antidepressant to put some high octane in the tank, so to speak. In some cases, this makes the psychotherapy more effective. If a patient feels strongly that she or he would like to receive an antidepressant at the initial evaluation, I treat with a combination of an antidepressant medication and psychotherapy right away. However, I almost never treat patients with antidepressant medications alone, as noted previously. In my experience, the drugs-only approach has not been satisfactory. The combination of medications with psychotherapy seems to produce better results in the short term and in the long term than treating patients with drugs alone. It may sound unscientific to base the medication decision on the patient's preferences, and certainly there are exceptional cases where I feel I have to make a recommendation that differs from my patient's wishes. But the majority of time, I have found that patients do well when treated with the approach they are most comfortable with. So if you are depressed and you have strong positive feelings that an antidepressant drug will help you, this increases the likelihood that you will be helped by one of these medications. And if you feel strongly that you would prefer to be treated with a drug-free form of therapy, the likelihood of a successful outcome is also good. But I would urge flexibility in your thinking. If you are receiving a medication, I strongly believe that cognitive or interpersonal psychotherapy can enhance your recovery. If you are receiving psychotherapy and your progress is slow, an antidepressant might accelerate your recovery. Can anyone take an antidepressant? Most people can, but competent medical supervision is a must. For example, special precautions are indicated if you have a history of epilepsy, heart, liver, or kidney disease, high blood pressure, or certain other disorders. For the very young and elderly, some medications should be avoided, and smaller doses may be indicated. And as noted above, if you are taking medicines in addition to an antidepressant, special precautions are sometimes required. Properly administered, an antidepressant is safe and may be life-saving, but don't try to regulate it or administer it on your own. Medical supervision is a must. Should a pregnant woman use an antidepressant? This sensitive question often requires consultation between the psychiatrist and the obstetrician. Since fetal abnormalities might occur, the potential benefit, the severity of the depression, and the stage of pregnancy must all be taken into account. Other treatment approaches should usually be employed first, and an active self-help program of the type described in this book might eliminate the need for a medication. This would give optimal protection to the developing child, of course. On the other hand, if the depression is very severe, there may be cases where it makes sense to use an antidepressant. Who is most and least likely to benefit from an antidepressant drug? Your chance of responding to an appropriate drug may be enhanced. 1, if you are unable to carry on with your day-to-day activities because of your depression. 2, if your depression is characterized by many organic symptoms, such as insomnia, agitation, retardation, a worsening of symptoms in the morning, or an inability to feel cheered up by positive events. 3, if your depression is severe. 4, if your depression had a reasonably clear-cut beginning. 5, if your symptoms are substantially different from the way you normally feel. 6, if you have a family history of depression. 7, if you have had a beneficial response to antidepressant drugs in the past. 8, if you strongly feel that you would like to take an antidepressant drug. 9, if you are strongly motivated to recover. 10, if you are married. Your chance of responding to an appropriate drug may be diminished, 1, if you are very angry, 2, if you have a tendency to complain and to blame others, 3, if you have a history of an exaggerated sensitivity to drug side effects, 4, if you have a history of multiple physical complaints that your doctor has been unable to diagnose, such as tiredness, stomach ache, headache, or pains in your chest, stomach, arms, or legs, 5, if you have a long history of another psychiatric disorder or hallucinations preceding your depression, 6, if you feel strongly that you do not want to take an antidepressant drug, 7, if you are abusing drugs or alcohol and you are unwilling to go into a recovery program, 8, if you are receiving financial compensation for your depression, or if you hope to receive financial compensation. For example, if you receive disability payments for depression, or if you are involved in a lawsuit and hope to receive financial compensation because of your depression, then any form of treatment is going to be difficult. This is because if you recover, you will lose money. This is a conflict of interest. 9. If you have failed to respond to other antidepressants you have been given. 10. If for any reason you have mixed feelings about getting better. These guidelines are of a general nature and are not intended to be comprehensive or precise. Our ability to predict who will respond best to a medication or to psychotherapy is still extremely limited. Many people with all the positive indicators may fail to respond to antidepressants, and many people with all the negative indicators may respond beautifully to the first drug they receive. In the future, the use of antidepressant drugs will hopefully become more precise and scientific, just as the use of antibiotics has become. If you have many of the negative indicators, is this bad? I don't think so. Most patients with all the negative indicators can be treated quite successfully, but it may sometimes take a little longer. In addition, as I have emphasized repeatedly, a combination of medication with good psychotherapy along the lines described in this book is sometimes more effective than treatment with antidepressant drugs alone. How fast and how well do antidepressant drugs work? Most studies indicate that approximately 60% to 70% of depressed patients will respond to an antidepressant medication. Since approximately 30% to 50% of depressed patients will also respond to a sugar pill, a placebo, these studies indicate that an antidepressant will increase your chances for recovery. However, remember that the word respond is different from the word recover, and the improvement from an antidepressant is often only partial. In other words, your score on a mood test, like the one in Chapter 2, may improve without going into the range considered truly happy, less than 5. This is why I nearly always combine antidepressant medication treatment with cognitive and behavioral techniques like those described in this book. Most people are not interested in just partial improvement. They want the real McCoy. They want to get up in the morning and say, "Hey, it's great to be alive." As I have emphasized, most of the depressed and anxious people I have treated have problems in their lives, such as a marital conflict or a career difficulty, and nearly all of them beat up on themselves with negative thinking patterns. In my experience, medication therapy is usually more effective and more satisfying when it is combined with psychotherapy. Many doctors do prescribe medications alone without psychotherapy, but I have not found this approach to be satisfactory. Which antidepressants are the most effective? All of the currently prescribed antidepressant drugs tend to work about equally well and equally rapidly for most patients. So far, no new type of antidepressant medication has been shown to be more effective or faster acting than the older drugs that have been available for several decades. However, there are dramatic differences in the costs of the different types of antidepressants and in the side effects they have. Essentially, the newer medications are much more expensive because they are still on patent. However, they are far more popular because they usually have fewer side effects than the older, cheaper drugs. If you have certain kinds of medical conditions, some antidepressants will be relatively safer for you than others. I will discuss these issues in greater detail in Chapter 20. Sometimes a patient will respond particularly well to one antidepressant or kind of antidepressant. Unfortunately, we cannot usually predict this ahead of time for the individual, and so most physicians use a trial-and-error approach. There are, however, a few generalizations about the kinds of antidepressants that work best for certain kinds of problems. For example, drugs that have stronger effects on the serotonin systems in the brain are generally considered to be effective for patients who suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder, called OCD for short. These patients have recurrent illogical thoughts, like a fear that the stove will catch fire and burn the house down, and perform compulsive rituals over and over, such as checking repeatedly to make sure that the stove is turned off. Drugs often prescribed for OCD include several of the tricyclic antidepressants, including clomipramine, anaphrenil, one of the SSRIs, such as fluoxetine, Prozac, or fluvoxamine, Luvox, or one of the MAOIs, such as tranylcypramine, Parnate. If a depressed patient also has symptoms of anxiety, such as panic attacks or social anxiety, the physician might also choose one of the SSRI or MAOI antidepressants, since these often seem to be quite effective. Or the physician might choose one of the more sedative antidepressants, such as trazodone, Desiree, or doxepin, Sinequan, thinking that the relaxation might help reduce the anxiety. In my practice, I have treated many patients with a particularly difficult type of chronic and severe depression known as borderline personality disorder, called BPD for short. Patients with this disorder have intense and constantly fluctuating negative moods, such as depression, anxiety, and anger. Patients with BPD also experience lots of turbulence in their personal relationships. In my experience, quite a few BPD patients have responded dramatically to the MAOI antidepressants, and so I might be more inclined to choose an MAOI for patients with these features. Of course, some patients with BPD have poor impulse control, and they may do better with one of the newer and safer antidepressants. This is because the MAOIs can be quite dangerous if patients mix these drugs with certain forbidden foods and medications that I will describe in detail in Chapter 20. There are a number of other guidelines as well, but they should not be taken too literally because there are so many exceptions to them. The bottom line is this. Any depressed patient has a reasonably good chance of having a positive response to almost any antidepressant medication if it is prescribed at the correct dose for a reasonable period of time. You can ask your physician if she or he has a reason for recommending a particular antidepressant. However, most physicians will prescribe antidepressants they are familiar with. This is good practice. Few doctors can master the myriad details about all the currently prescribed antidepressants, and so most doctors try to become familiar with the one or two agents they use most frequently. In this way, they will have the greatest expertise about the medication they are recommending for you. How can I tell if my antidepressant is really working? My own philosophy is to use a depression test like the one in Chapter 2 as a guide. Take the test once or twice a week during treatment. This is really important. The test will show whether and to what extent you have improved. If you are not getting better, or if you are getting worse, your scores will not improve. If your scores are steadily improving, this indicates the drug is probably helping. Unfortunately, most doctors do not require their patients to complete a mood test like the one in Chapter 2 between therapy sessions. Instead, they rely on their own clinical judgment to evaluate the effectiveness of the treatment. This is quite unfortunate because studies have indicated that doctors are often poor judges of how patients feel inside. How much mood elevation can I anticipate? Your aim should be to reduce the score on the depression test in Chapter 2 until it is in the range considered normal and happy. This is true whether you're being treated with an antidepressant, with psychotherapy, or with a combination of the two. Treatment cannot be considered completely successful if your score remains in the depressed range. If one antidepressant works somewhat, will it be even better to take two or more antidepressants at the same time? As a general rule, it is usually not necessary or even beneficial to take two or more different antidepressant drugs simultaneously. The two drugs may interact in ways that are unpredictable, and the side effects may increase substantially. There are exceptions to this, of course. For example, if you are restless and having trouble sleeping, your doctor may sometimes add a small dose of a second, more sedating antidepressant at night to help you get a good night's sleep. Or your doctor may add a small dose of a second antidepressant to try to increase the effectiveness of the first antidepressant. This is called an augmentation strategy, and I will discuss this approach in greater detail in Chapter 20. But on the average, one drug at a time usually works best. How long will it take before I can expect to feel better? It typically requires a minimum of 2 or 3 weeks before an antidepressant medicine begins to improve your mood. Some drugs may take even longer. For example, Prozac may not become effective for 5 to 8 weeks. It is not known why antidepressants have this delayed reaction, and whoever discovers the reason will probably be a good candidate for a Nobel Prize. Many patients have the impulse to discontinue their antidepressants before 3 weeks have passed because they feel hopeless and believe the medicine is not working. This is illogical since it is unusual for these agents to become effective right away. What can I do if my antidepressant doesn't work? I have seen many patients who failed to respond adequately to one or many antidepressants. In fact, at my clinic in Philadelphia, most of the patients were referred to me after unsuccessful treatments with a variety of antidepressant drugs and therapy as well. Most of the time, we were eventually able to get an excellent antidepressant effect, often through a combination of cognitive therapy and another medication that the patient had not yet tried. The important thing is to keep persisting in your efforts until you recover. Sometimes this requires enormous dedication and faith. Patients often feel like giving up, but persistence nearly always pays off. I have stated earlier that the feelings of hopelessness are probably the worst aspect of depression. These feelings sometimes lead to suicide attempts because patients feel so convinced that things will never get any better. They think that things have always been this way and that their feelings of worthlessness and despair will go on forever. In addition, there's a kind of genius about depression. Patients can be so incredibly persuasive about their hopelessness that even their doctors and families may start believing them after a while. Early in my career, I grappled with this and often felt tempted to give up on particularly difficult patients. But a trusted colleague urged me never to give in to the belief that any patient was hopeless. Throughout my career, this policy has paid off. No matter what type of treatment you receive, faith and persistence can be the keys to success. I cannot emphasize this enough. How long should I take an antidepressant if it doesn't seem to be working? Of course, you should always check with your physician before making any changes in your medication, but on average, a trial of 4 or 5 weeks should be adequate. If you do not have a clear-cut and fairly dramatic improvement in your mood, then a switch to another drug is probably indicated. It is important, however, that the dose be adjusted correctly during this time, since doses that are too high or too low may not be effective. Sometimes your doctor may order a blood test to make sure the dose you are taking is adequate for you. One of the commonest errors your doctor may make is to keep you on a particular antidepressant for many months or even years when there is no clear-cut evidence that you have improved. This makes absolutely no sense to me. However, I have seen many severely depressed individuals who reported that they had been treated continuously with the same antidepressant for many years but were not aware of any beneficial effects from the medication. Their scores on the mood test in Chapter 2 usually indicated they were still severely depressed. When I asked them why they were taking the drug for such a long time, They usually said that their doctors told them that they needed it, or that it was necessary because of their chemical imbalance. If your mood is not improved, it seems clear that the drug has not worked, so why keep taking it? If a drug does not have fairly substantial beneficial effects, as indicated by a clear and continuing improvement in your score on a depression test like the one in Chapter 2, then it is usually appropriate to switch to another antidepressant medication. How long should I continue to take the antidepressant if it does help me? You and your doctor will have to make this decision together. If this is your first episode of depression, you can probably go off the medicine after 6 to 12 months and continue to feel undepressed. In some cases, I have discontinued antidepressants after only 3 months with good results, and rarely found that treatment for more than 6 months was necessary. But different doctors have different opinions about this. One of the strongest predictors of relapse in research studies is the degree of improvement at the end of treatment. In other words, if you are happy and completely free of depression, and this is documented by a score below 5 on the depression test in Chapter 2, the likelihood of a prolonged depression-free period is high. On the other hand, if you are partially improved, but your depression score is still somewhat elevated, the likelihood is much greater that the depression will worsen or return in the future, whether or not you continue to take an antidepressant medication. This is another reason why I like to combine antidepressant medications with cognitive behavioral therapy. The patients usually have a much better response, and very few patients in my private practice appear to relapse and return for additional treatment following recovery. What if my doctor tells me I have to stay on the antidepressant indefinitely? Patients with certain kinds of depressions will almost definitely need to take medications on a long-term basis. For example, if a patient has bipolar, manic depressive illness, with uncontrollable highs as well as lows, long-term treatment with a mood-stabilizing medication such as lithium, valproic acid, or carbamazepine may be necessary. If you have had many years of unremitting depression, or if you have been prone to many recurrent attacks of depression, you might want to consider maintenance therapy for a longer period of time. Since doctors are becoming more aware of the relapsing nature of mood disorders, the use of antidepressants on a long-term or prophylactic basis is gaining greater favor. Some doctors routinely recommend therapy with antidepressants indefinitely, in much the same way they might insist that patients with diabetes must take daily insulin to regulate their blood sugar. Several research studies suggest that such maintenance therapy can reduce the incidence of depressive relapses. However, research studies also indicate that treatment with the cognitive therapy techniques described in this book can also reduce depressive relapses. In addition, these studies suggest that the preventive effect of cognitive therapy may be greater than the preventive effect of antidepressant medications. One important advantage of cognitive behavioral therapy is that you learn new skills to minimize or prevent future depressions. For example, the simple exercise of writing down and challenging your own negative thoughts when you are under stress can be invaluable. In my private practice, the vast majority of the depressed patients I have treated have not had to stay on antidepressant drugs indefinitely following recovery. Most of them did extremely well with no medications simply by using the cognitive therapy skills they learned whenever they became upset again in the future. This is very encouraging, and it shows there is quite a bit you can do not only to treat your own depression, but also to minimize the probability of severe and prolonged depressions in the future. It also suggests that if you are taking an antidepressant, it might be very helpful for you to study and practice the methods in this book. Once you discover how to change your own negative thinking patterns using the techniques I describe, you may find that you will be able to remain undepressed without any medications. But certainly, you will want to discuss this with your physician. It is never smart to go off a medicine or to change the dose of a medication unless you talk this over with your doctor first. What if I start getting more depressed when I taper off the medication? This is actually pretty common, and I will tell you how I have handled it in my own practice. First, I make sure the patient continues to take the depression test in Chapter 2 at least once or twice a week while she or he is tapering off the medication. Then we develop a plan for slowly reducing the dose of the antidepressant. I tell patients that if they start to feel depressed again while tapering off the drug, and this is reflected by an increased score on the depression test, then they should temporarily raise the dose slightly for a week or two. This usually leads to an improvement in mood again. Then they can slowly continue to taper off the drug again. This approach is reassuring because it puts the patient in control. After a couple tries like this, most patients have been able to taper off their antidepressants without becoming depressed again. What should I do if the depression comes back in the future? If your depression returns, the chances are excellent that you will again respond to the same drug that helped you the first time. It may be the proper biological key for you. So you can probably use that drug again for any future episode of depression. If any blood relative of yours develops a depression, this drug might also be a good choice for them, because a person's response to antidepressants, like the depression itself, appears to be influenced by genetic factors. The same reasoning applies to the psychotherapy techniques. I have found that for most people, the same kinds of events, for example being criticized by an authority figure, tend to trigger depression, and the same kinds of cognitive therapy technique usually reverse the depression for a particular patient. In most cases, patients have been able to reverse a new episode of depression fairly rapidly without having to take the medication again. I encourage my patients to come in for a little tune-up if they become depressed again in the future. Often, these tune-ups consisted of only one or two therapy sessions, since we were usually able to reapply the same technique that had helped them so much the first time I treated them. What are the most common side effects of the antidepressants? As discussed in Chapter 17, all the medications prescribed for depression, anxiety, and other psychiatric problems can cause different kinds of side effects. For example, many of the older antidepressants, such as amitriptyline, trade name Elavil, cause fairly noticeable side effects, such as dry mouth, sleepiness, dizziness, and weight gain, among others. Many of the newer antidepressants, such as fluoxetine, trade name Prozac, can cause nervousness, sweating, upset stomach, or a loss of interest in sex, as well as difficulties having an orgasm. I will describe the specific side effects of every antidepressant in Chapter 20, which is found on the enhancement. You will see that some medications produce lots of side effects, whereas others produce very few. The side effects checklist, which you'll also find on the enhancement, can provide you and your physician with extremely accurate information about any side effects that you experience while you're taking a medication. If you take this test a couple times per week, this will show how the side effects change over time. Remember, however, that many of these so-called side effects can occur even if you are not taking any medication, since many side effects are also symptoms of depression. Feeling tired, having trouble sleeping at night, or a loss of interest in sex would be good examples. So it can be very useful to complete the side effects checklist at least once or twice before you start any medication. That way, you can see if a side effect began before or after you started the drug. Obviously, if you had the same side effect before you started taking a drug, then the drug is probably not to blame for it. It is also good to remember that patients who only take placebo medications, sugar pills, during research studies, tend to report lots of side effects. This is because they think they are taking a real drug. So there is no proof that a particular side effect is necessarily caused by the drug you are taking. When in doubt, talk this over with your physician. Let me give you a particularly vivid example of how the mind can occasionally play tricks on us. I once treated a high school teacher for depression. She was not responding well to the psychotherapy, and I had the hunch that she would respond to a particular antidepressant drug called trencyclopromine, parnate, that is described in Chapter 20. However, she was somewhat stubborn and had a strong fear of taking any medication. She complained that she would not be able to tolerate the side effects. I explained that I planned to prescribe a low dose and that in my experience most patients did not have many side effects with this medication, especially when the dose was low. But my efforts were to no avail. She insisted the side effects of the drug would be unbearable and refused to accept a prescription. I asked if she would be willing to do a little experiment to check this out. I told her I would give her 2 weeks' worth of pills in 14 separate envelopes. Each envelope was labeled with the date and day of the week she was to take the pills inside it. I explained that some envelopes would contain placebo pills that could not have any side effects whatsoever. Half the pills would be yellow, and half would be red, but she would not know whether she was taking the real medication or a placebo on any given day. The envelope for the first day contained one yellow pill, and the envelope for the second day contained one red pill. The envelopes for the third and fourth days contained two yellow pills each, and the envelopes for the fifth and sixth days contained two red pills each. Finally, each envelope for the second week contained three yellow pills, or three red pills. I asked her to complete the side effects checklist every day and to record the date. I explained how this experiment would help us determine whether any side effects she experienced on a given day were due to the real drug or the placebo effect. She reluctantly agreed, but insisted that her body was very sensitive to drugs and predicted the experiment would prove just how wrong I was. Shortly after she started taking the pills, she started calling me almost daily with alarming reports about severe side effects, especially on the day she was taking the yellow pills. She said these effects also spilled over to the day she took the red pills as well. I explained the side effects usually diminished over time and encouraged her to try to continue. On Sunday evening, she had the answering service page me at home for an emergency. She stated that the side effects did not diminish, but were getting worse. In fact, they were so severe that she simply could no longer function. She was dizzy and confused and fatigued. Her mouth was as dry as cotton. She staggered when she tried to walk and could barely get out of bed. She had severe headaches. She said she would not take any more pills and wanted to know why I had put her through such grief. I apologized, told her to stop the medications immediately, and made an appointment to see her the first thing Monday morning for an emergency session. I reassured her that none of her symptoms sounded life-threatening, although she was obviously in great distress. I told her to bring her daily side effects checklists to the session and promised that we would break the code together the next morning so we could find out which days she had taken the placebos and which days she had taken the real pills. The next morning I explained that all the pills she had taken were placebos I had obtained from the hospital pharmacist. They were simply red placebos and yellow placebos. There were no parnate pills in any of the envelopes. This information surprised her, and tears began rolling down her cheeks. She acknowledged that she never would have believed that her mind could have such powerful effects on her body. She had been totally convinced the side effects were real. She then went ahead to take the Parnate in small doses, and her mood improved substantially over the next month or two. She also started working very hard on her psychotherapy homework between sessions. She continued to fill out the depression test and the side effects checklist once a week, but she did not report many side effects. I do not mean to imply that all side effects are in your mind. On rare occasions this can occur, but most of the time the side effects are quite real, and the vast majority of my patients have reported them accurately. If you use the side effects checklist on a daily basis, it will help you and your doctor assess the specific type and severity of any symptoms you might experience. Then the appropriate medication adjustments can be made if the side effects are excessive or dangerous. Why do antidepressant drugs have side effects? You learned in Chapter 17 that antidepressant drugs can stimulate or block the receptors for the neurotransmitter chemicals that nerves use to send messages to each other. In that chapter, we focused on serotonin, since this transmitter is felt to be involved in the regulation of mood. One of the most important and helpful discoveries of the past two decades is that antidepressants can also interact with the receptors for several additional chemical transmitters in the brain. These interactions appear to be responsible for many of the side effects of the antidepressants. The three brain receptors that have been studied the most intensively are called histamine receptors, alpha-adrenergic receptors, and muscarinic receptors. These are located on nerves that use histamine, norepinephrine, and acetylcholine, respectively, as their chemical transmitters. Drugs that block histamine receptors are called antihistamines, a term you are probably familiar with. Drugs that block alpha-adrenergic receptors are called alpha blockers, and drugs that block muscarinic receptors are called anticholinergics. Each type of receptor is responsible for certain kinds of side effects. You can predict the side effects of any drug if you understand how strongly the drug affects each of these three brain systems. Antidepressant medications produce many of their side effects because they block histaminic receptors, alpha-adrenergic receptors, and cholinergic receptors, which are also called muscarinic receptors, that are located on the surfaces of nerves inside of your brain and throughout your body as well. In case you do not recall what a receptor is, it is simply an area on the surface of a nerve that can turn the nerve on or off. The histamine receptors are located on nerves that use histamine as a chemical transmitter. The alpha-adrenergic receptors are located on nerves that use norepinephrine as a chemical transmitter. And the cholinergic receptors are located on nerves that use acetylcholine as a chemical transmitter. If you block any of these three types of receptors, you will turn the nerves off. The effects of different antidepressant medications on these three receptors help explain many of the side effects of these drugs. For example, amitriptyline, Elavil, is an older antidepressant that can cause many side effects, including sleepiness, weight gain, dizziness, dry mouth, blurred vision, and forgetfulness, to name just a few of the more common ones. Most of these side effects are not too dangerous, but they can be uncomfortable. Let's see if we can understand these side effects a little better by examining the effects of amitriptyline on the three kinds of nerve receptors. Scientists have learned that amitriptyline blocks the cholinergic, histamine, and alpha-adrenergic receptors in the brain. Let's examine its anticholinergic effects first. What do these cholinergic nerves ordinarily do? Among other things, they control the amount of lubrication in your mouth. If you stimulate cholinergic nerves, more fluids will flow into your mouth from glands that are located in your cheeks. What would happen if you turned off these nerves that normally lubricate your mouth? Your mouth would feel dry. You may have experienced a dry mouth when you were very nervous, cotton mouth, or when you were exercising for a long time in the sunshine without drinking any water. Cholinergic nerves also slow the heart, and so anticholinergic drugs like amitriptyline will cause the heart to speed up. Anticholinergic drugs can also cause forgetfulness, confusion, blurred vision, constipation, and difficulties getting your urine started. Amitriptyline also blocks alpha-adrenergic receptors on nerves that use norepinephrine as a transmitter substance. If you stimulate these alpha-adrenergic receptors, your blood pressure will usually increase. Conversely, when you block them, your blood pressure will usually fall. This is why amitriptyline can cause a drop in blood pressure in certain individuals. This problem is especially noticeable when you suddenly stand up, because the drop in blood pressure makes you dizzy. Dizziness when standing is a common side effect of amitriptyline and many other antidepressants. As noted above, amitriptyline also blocks histamine receptors in the brain. Drugs that block these receptors are called antihistamines. You've probably taken an antihistamine if you've had an allergy or stuffy nose. Drugs that block histamine receptors can make you sleepy and hungry. This is why amitriptyline, as well as many other antidepressant drugs that block histamine receptors, causes tiredness and weight gain. Many of the older antidepressant medications are categorized as tricyclic antidepressants. The tricyclics have relatively strong effects on these three kinds of brain receptors, and so they tend to cause quite a few side effects. In fact, on pages 530 to 532 in chapter 20, you will find a table that lists each tricyclic and shows how strong its effects are on each of these three types of brain receptors. This information indicates how strong the different kinds of side effects will be for each medication. In contrast, many of the newer antidepressants, such as Prozac and the other SSRIs, generally have only weak effects on the histaminic, alpha-adrenergic, and cholinergic receptors in the brain. Consequently, they usually produce fewer side effects than the older drugs like amitriptyline. For example, the SSRIs are less likely to cause sleepiness, excessive appetite, dizziness, dry mouth, constipation, and so forth. The SSRIs also have little effect on the rate or rhythm of the heart. However, we are now discovering that the SSRIs, such as Prozac, have new and different side effects of their own. For example, as many as 30% to 40% of the patients taking these drugs experience sexual difficulties, such as a loss of interest in sex or difficulties having an orgasm. They can also cause upset stomach, loss of appetite, weight gain, nervousness, difficulty sleeping, fatigue, tremor, and excessive sweating, and a number of other side effects. What can I do to prevent or minimize these side effects? The likelihood and severity of any side effect usually depends on the dose of the medication you are taking. As a general rule, if you start out with a small dose and increase the dose gradually, the side effects can be minimized. In addition, many side effects tend to diminish over time. Sometimes a reduction in dose will minimize side effects without reducing the effectiveness of an antidepressant. Sometimes a change to another type of antidepressant medication will be needed. If you and your doctor work together, you can usually find a medication that will have a beneficial effect on your mood without excessive side effects. Your doctor might also add a second medication to help combat the side effects of an antidepressant medication or a mood stabilizer. Sometimes this is necessary and justified, and sometimes it is not necessary. I will discuss this issue in greater detail in Chapter 20, but I will give you a couple of specific examples here. Let's assume that you are taking lithium for manic depressive illness. A common side effect of lithium is a tremor of the hands. You may find it difficult to write your name clearly, or your hand may shake while you are attempting to hold a cup of coffee. One of my patients trembled so much that the coffee would actually spill out of the cup. Obviously, such a severe side effect is not acceptable. Your doctor may add one of the drugs called beta blockers to help combat the tremor. The drug propranolol, Inderol, is often used for this purpose. However, beta blockers have potent effects on the heart, and they can also have a number of side effects of their own. Furthermore, both lithium and beta blockers have the potential for adverse interactions with other drugs your psychiatrist or family physician may prescribe. And so the situation